Welcome back to Mama Mystery. I am your host, Kelly. Happy Halloween. Happy Friday. I hope you all have had a great week. This week has been kind of crazy. I'm sure you noticed I didn't come out with a deep dive this week. It has just been too much between kids, class parties, conferences. I took Jack and Kennedy to go see the Beauty and the Beast in Kansas City. They're touring right now. And that production was so incredible. If you have a chance to see like a touring show like that, I know Hamilton, Wicked, Beauty and the Beast right now, some of these big productions that are touring, if you ever get a chance to see one, I just so highly recommend it, especially if you can bring your kids, because I feel like Jack and Kennedy both left so inspired. And it was so beyond our imagination of what a play or like a musical could be. I mean, it is so incredible. That's really all I can say about it. But if you ever have a chance to see a live show, I would highly recommend it. So we did that, and then we've had conferences and volleyball practices and just nonstop stuff. So I'll have a deep dive out for you guys next week, I promise. But we are going to do the weekly docket today. So I'm going to cover the top headlines in true crime for this week. And there is a lot to cover. So let's just go ahead and dive in. The first story we're going to cover was recommended to me by a listener, Angela Pop from Middletown, Ohio. So thank you so much to Angela for bringing this to my attention. I'd actually seen this story on my feed and I wanted to cover it. I knew I wanted to cover it and my brain just has too many tabs open. So I easily forget things. And then I have like over 500 notes in my phone. Like I gotta really figure out what's going on in my brain. I need to organize my brain. But all of that said, if you ever want to recommend a weekly docket case, go to mamamystery.com and you can send me a message directly from my website. Just make sure to tell me who you are if you want me to know and then possibly get a shout out. So this story took place in the small town of Lima, Montana, population just over 200. And there's not a lot that usually makes the headlines in Lima. It's the kind of rural place where people wave to one another from their trucks and everyone kind of knows everyone else's business, or at least they think they do. But on October 16th, Lima became the center of one of the most disturbing child neglect cases in Montana's recent history. That afternoon around 3 p.m., dispatchers in Beaverhead County received a call from 28-year-old Nicole Lynn Boyer. Her voice was calm but detached, and she told them something horrifying, that her 2-year-old son was dead. She said that he had been sick for months and that she wanted to report his death. Deputies immediately drove out to her home on Main Street, a 2-story house near the edge of town. And when they arrived, Boyer met them outside. According to the affidavit, her first words were chilling. She said, "Just take me to jail." The deputy followed her inside, where the smell hit them first. It was a thick, unmistakable odor of decomposition that hung heavy in the air. The house itself was in shocking condition. Investigators later described it as unsanitary and in poor condition, with piles of trash and dirty laundry covering nearly every surface. Rotten food set out in the open and animal feces were scattered across the floors. When they made their way upstairs, they found the little boy, identified in court documents only by his initials S.B., lying on a pile of laundry and trash beside a mattress. He was covered with a sweatshirt that Nicole told investigators belonged to her. An air conditioning unit was still running in the window despite the fact that it was just 44 degrees outside, an apparent attempt to slow down the decomposition process. SB's body was badly decomposed, indicating that he had been dead for several weeks. He was born with multiple serious medical conditions, including spina bifida, hydrocephalus, and club feet, all of which left him severely disabled and unable to walk. He couldn't stand or crawl normally. Instead, he would army crawl, dragging his body across the floor to reach what he needed. Boyer told investigators that she had once kept a close eye on him. She said she created a padded section in the upstairs bedroom where he stayed. She would leave food on the floor and fill a to-go bottle with water so that he could reach it himself. But as the months went on, she admitted she grew overwhelmed and began neglecting him. She confessed that she eventually stopped checking on him regularly and even stopped bringing him food and water altogether. In her own words, she said, "I believe I should have done more. My lack of not paying attention and prioritizing other things over him led to him dying," end quote. When investigators pressed her for more details, she said that she thought her son had been dead for weeks. She claimed she convinced herself that he was still alive, even though she hadn't seen him move or breathe, and she admittedly stopped bringing him food and water. And at some point in September, she admitted she stopped caring for him altogether. She told investigators she stopped giving him Tylenol, which she had been using to treat his fevers, because she was worried she might overdose him. She also said she didn't take him to the doctor because she believed she had everything she needed at home, over-the-counter medications and her own care, which is really so contradictory to everything else she's saying. So I don't know if she just says those things to make an excuse for herself, but for a while she told herself that he was just sleeping longer than usual. Then as the days passed, she realized what had happened, but just couldn't bring herself to face it. Instead, she left him where he lay. Investigators believe SB died sometime in mid-September, about a month before she finally made that 911 call. When authorities searched the rest of the home, they found other children living there and one adult. The adult, I've seen questions on this. A lot of people assume that this was like her husband or maybe the child's father, but reports that I'm seeing suggest that this might actually be her father or father-in-law or an older adult that she was apparently taking care of. All were immediately removed by the Montana Department of Public Health and Human Services. According to neighbors, Boyer had two other children who occasionally played outside, but that they hadn't seen the youngest one in months. One neighbor said, "We all knew that the boy was sick, but nobody knew it was this bad." Court documents reveal that when questioned by agents with the Montana Department of Criminal Investigation, Nicole said that at one point she was checking on him several times a day, but that she began sleeping downstairs with her other child instead of in the same room with SB. She acknowledged that she hadn't given him water in weeks and could not remember the last time he ate. She told agents that she had known something was wrong for a long time, but she just kept convincing herself that he was still breathing, that she was maybe just imagining things. And when asked why she finally decided to call authorities, she said she just couldn't take it anymore. The medical examiner's office has not yet released the full autopsy results, but preliminary findings confirm that the child's death was caused by prolonged neglect and starvation. Following her arrest, Boyer was charged with one count of deliberate homicide, which under Montana law means that she knowingly or purposely caused the death of another human being. She was booked into the Beaverhead County Jail and ordered held on a $500,000 bond. During her first court appearance, she appeared in an orange jail uniform, and I'm going to put a picture of her on the cover art for this episode so you can see who we are talking about. And her hair was pulled back, I mean, somewhat. It was really disheveled. Her face was expressionless, and she entered a plea of not guilty. The judge ordered that SB's body not be cremated until investigators could complete additional forensic testing, including examination of the bedroom and the home's environmental conditions. Family members later told detectives they hadn't seen or spoken to the child since September. Boyer's own mother told police that her daughter had made several cryptic comments, saying things like she was a horrible mother and that she was going to go to jail for life. Which, to that, I have to ask, why wouldn't you say something if she was saying stuff like that? Like, if my daughter came to me and said that she was a horrible mother and that she was going to jail for life, that would definitely raise some red flags in my mind, and I would ask her to elaborate, please. Why would you think that you're going to jail for life? This could have been handled much sooner had this girl's mom also stepped up. But the court documents also revealed that Boyer had a long history of instability, both financial and emotional. There are no prior child abuse charges in her record, but neighbors say the home had long been in disarray and that Boyer often seemed overwhelmed trying to care for her children. And I wonder also if there will be additional child abuse charges because of the other children that were living in this home while their young sibling was upstairs, not alive. So what investigators found inside the home painted a very clear picture of isolation. There were no recent medical supplies, there were no active prescriptions for the child's conditions, and no evidence of any scheduled doctor visits. The small upstairs bedroom where SB lived and died had been sealed off from the rest of the house with a baby gate and piles of boxes. The smell of decay had been masked only slightly by the running air conditioner and an open window. The autopsy confirmed what detectives had suspected. The boy had been dead for weeks before Boyer finally called for help. So now, as the case moves toward trial, prosecutors in Beaverhead County are describing it as one of the most disturbing child neglect cases they have ever handled. In court filings, they said the evidence will show a pattern of conscious disregard for the child's life. Boyer's defense attorney has not issued a public statement, but sources close to the case suggest that she may argue mental health struggles or extreme caregiver burnout as an excuse as to why this happened. As of now, Nicole Lynn Boyer remains behind bars awaiting trial. Her surviving children are now in state custody. I've seen a lot of comments regarding this case that reflect compassion for this mother because she was so overwhelmed, apparently. But to that, I just have to say my compassion really lies with the 2-year-old child and the other children having to live in that home. Children don't get to choose who their parents are. They don't get to choose the home they're brought home to. So I really think that when you are a parent, you are responsible and you have these responsibilities. You will be held liable should something happen to your children like this. There are resources. If you were that overwhelmed or if you felt like you really couldn't handle it anymore, you go to a doctor, you call somebody before it gets this bad. There are resources. So I don't want to hear excuses as for why this happened and why it was allowed to happen for as long as it did, and then why he laid on top of a pile of laundry among trash for over a month. There is absolutely no excuse for it. So I understand a lot of people have compassion, and I feel like our generation is becoming more and more sensitive to certain situations. But to that, I just have to say, had you seen the scene that this baby was laying in, maybe you would think differently. I know I'm just telling you the story, but if you can only imagine what the inside of that house was like, and there was one adult in charge who had the opportunity. She had a phone. You have a phone. You could easily just call 911 and say, I'm afraid something bad is going to happen to these kids. I can't take it anymore. I can't take care of my 2-year-old anymore. You call somebody. There's just absolutely no excuse. So maybe I'm kind of isolated in that opinion, and I'm fine with that. But with that, we'll move on to our next story, which comes out of North Carolina, where a father's 911 call led to the discovery of 4 children in his car trunk. So on the night of October 28th, dispatchers in Johnston County, North Carolina, received a 911 call from a man who said something no one ever wants to hear. 38-year-old Wellington Delano Dickens III calmly told the operator that he had killed his children. When deputies arrived at his home on Springtooth Drive in Zebulon, they were met with a scene straight out of a nightmare. Inside the house, they found a 3-year-old boy still alive, but when they opened the trunk of a vehicle that was parked in the garage, they discovered the remains of 4 other children. Investigators quickly realized this was not a recent crime scene. The bodies had been there for months. The victims were later identified as Dickens' children, ages 6, 9, and 10, along with his 18-year-old stepson. According to the sheriff's office, the timeline of deaths stretched all the way back to May of 2025. The youngest child, Leah, was believed to have been killed first. 2 of her siblings, Zoe and Wellington Jr., were killed later that summer, around August. The oldest, 18-year-old Sean Brassfield, is believed to have been killed in September. Each of the victims had been homeschooled, which, according to authorities, may have helped explain why no one noticed that they were missing. Their deaths went undetected for months until Wellington Dickens picked up the phone and then finally confessed. Deputies took Dickens into custody that night, and he now faces 4 counts of first-degree murder. Each charge carries the possibility of life in prison without parole or the death penalty under North Carolina law. During a press conference, Johnston County Sheriff Steve Bazell shared that Dickens' wife, Stephanie, had died in April of 2024 while she was pregnant. The loss appeared to have marked a turning point in his mental state, but authorities haven't said whether it played a direct role in the murders. What makes this case even harder to wrap your head around is how long it went unnoticed. Months passed, spring, summer, and into fall, with 4 children missing and a 5th still living under the same roof. Investigators haven't publicly discussed any kind of motive, but they did confirm that the three-year-old survivor has been placed in the care of Child Protective Services. Neighbors in the quiet Zebulon community told reporters that they were stunned. One neighbor said she often saw the children playing in the yard months earlier, but hadn't realized that they stopped appearing. Others mentioned that Dickens mostly kept to himself after his wife's death. The sheriff described the investigation as one of the worst his department has ever handled, noting that it wasn't just a single act of violence, but a series of killings that spanned nearly a half a year. As of now, investigators are still working to determine how each child was killed and whether anyone else had knowledge of what happened inside that home. It's a case that's left even seasoned investigators shaken, not just because of the brutality, but because of the quiet normalcy that surrounded it for so long. So when I finish every episode and I say, stay curious, stay vigilant, this is the type of stuff I mean. Like, the neighbors, noticed that the kids were outside all the time, then they stopped appearing. Like, stay vigilant in those situations. The neighbors of the first story, like, if you notice that there are kids outside playing and then they suddenly aren't, or that something appears in disarray, or maybe that the mom looks like she's struggling, step in and do something. Be vigilant. You know, that's really what I mean by that. With that, we're going to move on to the next story. 1 year after 36-year-old tech executive Caitlin Tracy's body was found at the bottom of a high-rise stairwell, investigators secured an arrest warrant for her estranged husband, 47-year-old attorney Adam Beckering, charging him with first-degree murder. In late October of 2024, residents of the glass and steel condo tower where Beckering lived with Tracy noticed a sudden absence. Tracy was reported missing by her husband, who told police that he hadn't seen her in weeks. Yet surveillance footage reportedly contradicted that claim, showing the couple together just days before her body was discovered. When her body was eventually recovered from the 24-floor stairwell, the scene was pretty grim. A fall from height, multiple injuries, and the tragic conclusion of a highly protected life. Her death was ruled by the Cook County Medical Examiner as resulting from multiple injuries due to a fall from height, though the manner of death was initially listed as undetermined. Delving into the months prior to Tracy's death, investigators uncovered a pattern of escalating domestic violence. A 911 call made in January of 2024 captured her desperate plea when she said, "Please hurry." She told dispatchers that Beckering had pushed her, was drunk, and had assaulted her. In November of 2023, Tracy obtained a protective order against Beckering, citing ongoing abuse, one that she later withdrew under circumstances that remain murky. By August of 2024, police were again called to their Michigan residence after a disturbance, and Beckering pleaded no contest to domestic violence and contempt charges and was sentenced to 93 days in jail, only days before the anniversary of Tracy's disappearance. And then on October 28th of this year, exactly 1 year after Tracy's death, a Cook County judge approved the warrant charging Beckering with first-degree murder. According to the complaint, investigators believe he threw Tracy over the railing of the stairwell in his condo building. Beckering remains in custody in Michigan, having been detained following his sentencing there, and will eventually be transferred to Illinois to face the murder charge. Cases like this kind of remind me of the Ellen Greenberg case. These are both women who are engaged or married to powerful figures. In this case, he was an attorney, and so she probably felt a lot of the time like she was trapped and maybe didn't know how to get out of this, especially when you're married to a high-powered attorney. I'm sure you can really feel like the law is not going to be on your side. Similarly to the Ellen Greenberg case, she was living with this person who comes from a very wealthy family, has very strong connections. It is my personal opinion, based on the things that I know about that case, that there is some likelihood he could have something to do with Ellen's death. Unfortunately, though, the outcomes of these two stories appear to be very different, because Ellen, there is no justice in that case. They're still declaring that it was a homicide, or that it was a suicide, rather. And in this case, it's actually kind of refreshing to see someone be held accountable for something that they did, even though I don't know how they will be able to prove that he shoved her. I think that maybe the investigators in the Ellen Greenberg case could take some notes from this one, that sometimes really what you need is common sense and drive to figure out exactly what happened, and some will to come to justice. I wish I could see that in the Ellen Greenberg case, but until then, we'll go ahead and move on to the next story. Have you heard of Hormone Harmony by Happy Mammoth? It's the supplement designed to help women maintain optimal hormone levels. With more than 50,000 glowing reviews worldwide and 98% of women saying that they would recommend it to their friends and family, it's clear why it's such a fan favorite. And now you can take those results even further with their prebiotic collagen protein. This product is all about supporting your gut health, which directly impacts your hormones. When your gut is in balance, it can really amplify the benefits of Hormone Harmony. So here's what it helps with. It helps with relieving occasional bloating and gas, check. Reducing sugar cravings so you feel satisfied longer, definitely need that. Supporting healthy, sustainable weight management, which is something I have always struggled with. And boosting energy and supporting general well-being. Again, I think all moms can probably relate to basically all of those symptoms. But personally, I've noticed that adding prebiotic collagen protein to my routine made a big difference. It's given me more energy during the day and just an overall feeling of balance. Like I'm not on this wild roller coaster of hormonal imbalance. And what I really like about Happy Mammoth is their commitment to quality. Their products are inspired by nature, but backed by science, and they never cut corners. Right now, you can try prebiotic collagen protein and Hormone Harmony risk-free and get 15% off your entire first order with the code MAMA, that's M-A-M-A, at checkout. Just go to happymammoth.com and use the code MAMA for 15% off today.
Hey guys, finding the perfect gift for the food lover in your life is easy, thanks to Gold Belly. Gold Belly ships America's most iconic foods straight from world-famous restaurants right to your door. So if you want to treat someone to Joe's Stone Crab from Miami, Franklin Barbecue from Texas, or desserts from famous foodies like Ina Garten or Martha Stewart, Gold Belly has you covered with free shipping anywhere in the country. Just go to goldbelly.com and for a limited time, get 20% off your first order with promo code GIFT. That's promo code GIFT.
This one is kind of different from one that I typically cover, but I do just find it so fascinating. So on the morning of October 19th, just after 9:30 a.m., a group of intruders dressed in high visibility vests and posing as maintenance workers pulled off one of the most daring museum hits in recent French history. They drove a stolen truck with a boom lift to the south facade of the Louvre, positioned the lift to reach a second floor balcony of the famed, Galerie d'Apollon, home to the remnants of the French crown jewels, and with minutes broke into the gallery. Two of the thieves ascended the lift, used angle grinders to cut through the glass, and smashed open display cases. From the scene, investigators estimate the entire intrusion lasted just between 4 and 7 minutes, with the actual display case break-in occurring in under 4 minutes. The haul was 8 priceless jewels from France's royal collection, including an emerald and diamond necklace once gifted by Napoleon I and a tiara that belonged to Empress Eugenie. Their value was officially estimated at 88 million euros, which is around $100 million, though museum officials emphasized that their historical value was immeasurable. As the thieves fled, they abandoned one of the crowns, which was Eugenie's, on the street, damaged in the getaway. Within a week, investigators had pulled together enough forensic evidence between helmets, gloves, cutting tools, lift components, vehicle traces, all to identify the suspects. On October 25th, police arrested two men in their 30s, both from the Seine-Saint-Denis area of just north of Paris. One was intercepted at Charles de Gaulle Airport as he prepared to fly to Algeria, and the other suspect was arrested in a suburb but did appear to have plans to fly to Mali, apparently. I've also seen some reports that more people have been arrested in this, so it seems like they're gonna wrap this up and hopefully they can retrieve those jewels. It just kind of reminded me of the movie Tangled. And I know that there are serious implications and thankfully there were no lives lost, just damage to very priceless and respected jewelry, but it's just crazy to think that like things like this still happen in 2025. So I don't know, I guess we'll just see what ends up happening. Hopefully it can all get recovered and back in its appropriate spot. I do think that, precious jewels like that and just, like artifacts, precious artifacts like that are so fascinating. And so I do understand the importance of like retrieving these and respecting these jewels. I just found this story to be really interesting. So let me know what you think about it. Next, we're going to downtown Montgomery, where a mass shooting ignited after a college football weekend. On the night of October 4th, downtown Montgomery, Alabama was flooded with energy. Crowds had gathered, some for the football game between Tuskegee, I'm probably mispronouncing that. I mispronounce so much, and I think it's so funny when people let me know that I'm mispronouncing something. They're always kind about it, but I'm like, man, I just am not really good at that, but I can own it. Anyway, there was a football game between Tuskegee University and Morehouse College. Others for the annual fair and nightlife in the city's entertainment district all gathered, and there was just high energy among this crowd. Then around 11:30 p.m., the vibe had shifted dramatically from celebration to terror. Witnesses described a heavy crowd near the intersection of Commerce Street and Bibb Street in the heart of downtown. Suddenly, gunfire erupted, not from one shooter, but from two groups whose confrontation quickly spiraled. According to police, the violence began when one person was targeted. Almost immediately, others in the crowd drew their weapons and began firing. By the time the police had secured the area, 14 people had been shot. Two were dead, a 17-year-old named Jeremiah Morris and a 43-year-old woman identified as Shalonda Williams. Jeremiah Morris was a high school student from Montgomery and, according to his family, had gone downtown with friends after the football game. His mother told reporters that her son had plans to go to trade school and was just truly in the wrong place at the wrong time. Police believe he was not involved in the altercation that sparked the shooting. He was just an innocent bystander caught in the crossfire. Shalonda Williams worked locally in Montgomery and was described by friends as a joyful spirit, always smiling. She was downtown with relatives attending the fair earlier in the evening and stopped near Commerce Street for some late-night food when the gunfire erupted. Witnesses said that she was struck while she was trying to take cover near a parked car. Seven of the victims were under the age of 20. At least one was a child. Five of the wounded were in critical condition. Investigators recovered multiple weapons and shell casings of different calibers. Police described the scene as two parties just shooting at each other in the middle of a crowd. The shooters did not care about any of the people around them. Shortly after the shooting, the investigation began and a juvenile had already been charged. Then on October 14th, authorities announced that 19-year-old Dantavius McGee was arrested and charged with one count of capital murder, nine counts of first-degree assault, and three counts of second-degree assault in connection with the incident. Police continue to say more arrests are expected. Then, just 1 week later, on the night of October 11th, the small town of Leland, Mississippi, population just a few thousand in the Mississippi Delta, was shaken as a community tradition, unraveled into tragedy. The hometown football homecoming game had ended, and residents poured into Main Street for the post-game celebration. But around midnight, gunshots erupted. Witnesses say the shooting started near the intersection of 4th Street and North Main Street, where crowds had gathered to socialize. What many described as an after-party in the street turned chaotic almost instantly. One observer said dozens of people dropped to the pavement when volleys of rounds began. Several described hearing hundreds of shots, a rapid, sustained barrage that gave little to no time for panic to subside. By morning, the scale of the carnage became clear. At least seven people were killed and more than a dozen were wounded by gunfire. Among the dead were Orishama Johnson, who was only 41 years old, Calvin Plant, who was 19, Shelbyana Powell, who was 25, Caselyn Johnson, who was only 18, Amos Brantley Jr., who was also 18 years old and actually died the following morning from his injuries, LaMichael Jones was only 34 years old, who also died from his wounds, and then Ebony Williams, who was only 25, and she succumbed to injuries days after the shooting. At least 18 others were shot, many taken to hospital, some airlifted for critical care. Earlier that evening, the high school homecoming festivities at Leland High School had drawn a crowd. Students, alumni, families, music, tailgating. It was huge. And after the game ended, people streamed into downtown for what was meant to be a celebratory extension of the event. But as the crowd grew dense on Main Street around midnight, a disagreement among individuals escalated, and according to authorities, that conflict became the catalyst. Surveillance footage and witness accounts describe multiple people with firearms in the crowd, some concealed, others less so. One witness reported hearing continuous automatic fire bursts, panic spreading through the gathering, people diving for cover, others sprinting away through alleys and parked car zones. The downtown block was not designed for that scale of crisis. It quickly became a crime scene with bodies, injured people calling out, emergency vehicles arriving under chaotic conditions. Local police, county sheriffs, and the FBI all responded. The FBI established a digital media tips line to collect videos and photos from witnesses, urging anyone with smartphone footage to come forward. Within days, authorities had multiple arrests. By October 16th, 9 people were in custody connected to the shooting. Among those charged were Tevion L. Powell, 29 years old, and these all have a capital murder charge unless I say otherwise. William Brandt, who was 29, Morgan Lattimore, who was only 25, and then Latoya Powell, who was 44 years old. She actually has a attempted murder charge and is the aunt of Shelbiana Powell, who was one of the victims. And then Tara Gurnall S. Martin, who was only 33 years old, was also later arrested and charged with capital murder. Authorities say that the shooting was not random, but appears tied to a specific dispute among individuals in the crowd. Investigators, however, have not yet publicly disclosed a definitive motive. In cases like these, I don't think that there typically is a motive. I think that these people with guns are acting on emotion and they just don't know how to control their tempers. And so it just ends up in mass casualties. I think it actually is that simple, and that simplicity of it makes it that much more heartbreaking because this is just so senseless. And these split-second decisions not only take the lives of other people, but ruin their futures too over just getting heated over a disagreement. It's very frustrating and disappointing to keep seeing this happen. Now, with all of that said, that is it for today's weekly docket. Let me know what you think of these stories. I hope you all have a great Halloween weekend. With that said, stay vigilant, stay curious. Mama Mystery out, and happy Halloween. We'll be right back.